Remote hearings are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Welcome to the inaugural meeting of the E12 Education Finance Conference Committee for the 2021 session. Members have the contents of their virtual packets available to them, and for the public, these materials have all been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they're attached to the calendar event that you have that Ms. Burke sent out for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burke will place your name on the list to be recognized. We do hope that there will be lively discussion today. Ms. Sunderland, would you please call the roll of the House members?
Chair Dabney.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Hassan.
Present.
Representative Cresha.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
And that is our roll.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderland. Will the Senate Legislative Assistant now take the roll of the Senate members?
Yeah. Senator Chamberlain.
Present.
Senator Dornink.
Present.
Senator Duckworth.
Present.
Senator Eichhorn.
Present.
Senator Weaker.
Present.
That's the roll for the Senate.
Thank you very much. Members, since this is the first time we are gathering together, we wanted to welcome all of you to the E12 Conference Committee. Happy Teacher Appreciation Week. Seems like an auspicious way to start the E12 Conference Committee process. Mr. Chair, I hope that we have a positive and productive working relationship that yields a meaningful investment in Minnesota students, families, schools, and communities so that everyone can thrive. On the House side, we believe that all children deserve a world-class education, and it's our responsibility to provide that. I hope we can find the common ground necessary for productive conversations over these next 2 weeks or less. I think today, members, you'll see at least two dynamics that have animated our deliberations: the need for more equitable educational experiences and outcomes for Minnesota students, and the need to have youth voices themselves as a central part of our deliberations. I'd like to start by going around the table and giving members the opportunity to introduce themselves. If you care to share with us what school districts you represent and a priority for you as we prepare for our task of negotiating a final E12 agreement, that would be great. I can start, and then members, just to throw things off a little bit here, keep people on their toes, we'll go alphabetically. So that will mean a little bit of incorporating House and Senate members in the list. I'm Representative Jim Dabney. I have the privilege of representing House District 63A, which is part of South Minneapolis. I often refer to it as South Minneapolis along the river. And I represent the Minneapolis School District. I'm a product of the Minneapolis Public Schools. My wife is as well. My daughter graduated in 2018, and those who were here a little earlier may have picked up that my son graduates in just a few weeks. So we're looking forward, excited for that. Chair Chamberlain?
Good afternoon, everybody. To kind of tag on to your comments just quickly earlier, I am fully confident we're going to come out with something that is going to be good for our students and our schools across the state. I am Senator Roger Chamberlain. I live in Lionel Lakes, represent District 38, which is mostly White Bear Lake District, White Bear Lakes area schools, and then Centennial Schools, with a piece of Anoka Hennepin and a piece of Forest Lake. I don't believe I've left anybody else out, maybe a little bit of Matamidi area. I graduated from Cooper High School, and they've grown and changed quite a bit since I was back there in the day. Anyway, looking forward to it. Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Chamberlain. Senator Dornink. Sorry, I know I just mispronounced that. Dornink?
Dornick.
Dornick. My apologies. I'll try
fine.
To get it better. Welcome.
Thank you. Senator Gene Dornick, District 27. There's 10 school districts, which is so a lot of smaller schools, the biggest ones being Austin, Albert Lee, And I look forward to learning with you and supporting the kids, the teachers, and the parents, and working through this process together. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Duckworth.
Oh, good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chair and fellow conference committee members. I'm Senator Zach Duckworth out of District 58. I live in Lakeville, and some of the school districts I'm honored to represent are the Lakeville School District, of which I'm a graduate and the former school board member of, as well as Farmington, Randolph, and parts of Northfield, and some other districts throughout the Senate District 58 as well. So thank you for your time. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. Senator Eichhorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Senator Justin Eichhorn. I'm from Grand Rapids. I represent several school districts around the Grand Rapids, Bemidji, and Walker areas. I'm excited to be on the Education Conference Committee and look forward to getting to work with y'all.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Hassan.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Houghton Hassan. I represent District 62A, which is South Minneapolis, along Lake Street. I think Lake Street is the most famous street on my district. I represent a Minneapolis School District. I'm not a product of Minneapolis School District, but I'm heavily invested in Minneapolis School District, and I'm heavily invested in equity and creating an opportunity for all of our students to get a meaningful education so they can lead a productive and successful life. I'm super excited, and I hope we're gonna have tons of fun and come up with a very great outcome for our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my camera on my iPad still seems to be non-functioning, so you guys will all enjoy not having the video. My goals are that we get a budget and a policy together here that helps address what the schools have struggled through for the last year and beyond, including special ed, and making sure that we really understand what those challenges have been and how we can address those, and then how those challenges can be leveraged into other things that I know we're working on in other areas. So I fully expect it'll be a good conversation and that we'll get to some agreements that we can all vote for.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Representative Moran.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm State Representative Rena Moran, representing District 65A here in St. Paul, including the Rondo community. I am excited to be able to participate in the conference committee and look forward to some great outcomes on behalf of our children and families and our schools and our teachers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Pryor.
Thank you. So I grew up in Southern Minnesota, a product of the Austin School District. As has been mentioned already, my kids graduated from Hopkins school system, and now our school-age grandchildren all go to the Minneapolis schools. So I definitely have a perspective from around the state of school districts. Right now I'm representing the Hopkins District, the Minnetonka District, and the Eden Prairie District. So some of the largest school districts in the state and the largest high schools in the states as well as that. And I guess my goal is to really come together and understand our different perspectives and come up with solutions that really meet all the needs and all the critical needs of our kids across the state. And I am very much invested in this because I know, you know, I've got a two-year-old grandchild, and he's going to be going to school, and these kids are growing up, and it matters, you know, what our school districts are like and what our education system is like for the future. So very much invested in education.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ruth Richardson, and I represent District 52B, which includes where I live, Mendota Heights, Inver Grove Heights, Sunfish Lake, and portions of Eagan as well. I have three school districts in my district. districts 196, 197, and 199. And just want to lift up a couple of the other priorities that other members had, because I think that there's some alignment with Representative Kreisha. Ensuring that we're having an effective COVID response is very important, and also lifting up what Rep. Hassan said about addressing the long-term and unacceptable disparities that we see within education within the state as well, with the forethought to ensure that we're building a system that ensures every child has an opportunity to reach their full potential.
And rounding out the members of the committee, Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, conference committee colleagues. I'm Chuck Wieger. I'm from Maplewood, District 43. For the reps, that would be Representative Fisher and Lilly. The school districts I have include North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, where I served as school board chair and was on there for about 20 years before coming to the Senate. I also have the White Bear Lake School District, Matamidi, and Roseville districts. I'm the ranking member minority for the E-12 committee. I'm in my 25th year in the Senate. Like all of you, education's my passion. I strongly share the goal of addressing successfully and equitably the challenges of the pandemic. And the same goes for the equal challenge and continuing challenge of addressing systemic racism. Together, let's get this worked out as efficiently as we can and get a much higher target than what we are sending over from the Senate.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Members and staff, I would now like to give the opportunity for staff to introduce themselves. Unfortunately, I do not have a comprehensive list, but I would like everyone to know who else is in the room. So I think the easiest way to do this is for me to simply go left to right on my screen and hope that nobody moves the way Zoom sometimes rearranges the boxes in the next few minutes. So listen for your name, I guess, is the best advice I can give at this point, starting with Mr. Strong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and conferees. My name is Tim Strom, and I'm from House Research, and I'm glad to be of use to you all during conference committee this year.
Ms. Pera.
Good afternoon, conferees. My name is Christina Pera, also from House Research.
And I'm going to try on this next one. Good Scandinavian. Is it Helseth?
Good afternoon. Ms. Jelseth, but that was good. Yeah, I'm on Senate Council. I'm the analyst, so Mr. Strom's counterpart.
I usually say I'm pretty in touch with my inner Norwegian, but apparently not in touch enough. So my apologies, Ms. Jelseth.
It's okay.
Ms. Lewis.
Hello, I'm Anne-Marie Lewis. I'm counsel to the Senate's Education Committee and happy to be here.
Thank you. Ms. Adrians.
Hi, everyone. My name is Emily Adrians, and I am the fiscal staff on the House side. So I am Ms. Hofer's counterpart.
And next is Ms. Hofer's. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jenna Hofer. I am the fiscal analyst to the Senate Education Committee and Ms. Adrian's counterpart.
Ms. McGinnis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and conferees. My name is Cass McGinnis, and I handle the education portfolio in the revisor's office and a product of Minnesota education.
It occurs to me that we rarely actually get to hear the voices of the revisor's staff in committee deliberations. So welcome.
We try to stay tucked away.
Ms. Mock.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Annie Mock, and I'm with House Research.
Ms. Burt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Sarah Burt, the committee administrator for the Education Finance Committee in the House.
Mr. Rudquist.
Hello, conferees. I'm Mars Beltrandi Rudquist. I'm DFL Caucus Research Staff for the House.
Ms. Livingston.
Hello, I'm Nancy Livingston. I work for Senator Wieger. I'm his legislative assistant. I'm also happened to be a school board member for 20 years in District 622, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale. So pleased to be here.
Very good. Let's see, moving along, Mr. Cook.
Good afternoon, committee members and Mr. Chair Ed Cook. I'm a researcher with the Senate Republican Caucus.
Ms. Elling.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Dana Elling. I'm a researcher with the Senate DFO Caucus and a product of Minnesota Rural Public Schools and the University of Minnesota. Nice to see you all.
Thank you. Ms. Taken-Holtze.
Hi, Laura Taken-Holtze. I am the committee administrator for the Education Policy Committee in the House.
I'm going to guess that the square labeled Senate Education is Mr. Marcus.
Yes, that's correct. Chair Dabney, Greg Marcus here. Hello, everybody. I'm the committee administrator with the Senate E12 committee.
Mr. Withers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jody Withers with House Republican Research.
Thank you. And the last person I think on my screen is Ms. Donovan. If I've missed anyone inadvertently, my apologies. Jump in after Ms. Donovan. Welcome.
Ms. Donovan, you might be muted.
Yeah, I am muted. I'm in the same room with our CA, and so we get feedback when I mute or unmute. I'm Judy Donovan. I'm Greg Marcus's sidekick. I'm the LA of the Senate Education Committee with Senator Chamberlain. It's a pleasure to be.
I like the idea of your business card, though, saying, you know, sidekick.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks. Did I miss anyone?
Ms. Sunderland currently isn't on the Zoom, but she's our CLA.
Yes. Thank you for that. So, members, for today, we're going to begin with a series of presentations to the conference committee that frame how racial disparities are impacting the way education is delivered in our E12 system. Members, you received the agenda earlier today from Ms. Burt. There will be time for questions following each of the presentations today, except for the first one. Dr. Kamara Jones, who we're beginning with, unfortunately can't be here today, but we're lucky enough to have a presentation that she gave to the House Education Policy Committee earlier this session. Excuse me. Are there any questions before we begin? Seeing none. All right. The tape will begin with Chair Richardson introducing Dr. Jones. And now through the magic of Zoom.
Are completed. Our first presenter of today is Dr. Kamara Jones. Dr. Jones is the past president of the American Public Health Association. She is the 2019-2020 Evelyn Green Davis Fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. She is an adjunct professor at Harvard University within the Rowland School of Public Health at Emory University as well, and is a senior fellow and adjunct associate professor for Morehouse School of Medicine. Dr. Jones is not only a medical doctor, but also holds a master's in public health and her doctorate as well. And so with that, I will turn it over to you, Dr. Jones. You should have the ability to share your screen and begin your presentation.
Thank you so much, Representative Richardson. Thank you to the Education Policy Committee for having this hearing and for inviting me to be a speaker. I'm going to share my screen.
And Dr. Jones, yes. If you wouldn't just mind restating your name too, right before you get started. I should have said that.
I surely will. So I am Dr. Kamara Phyllis Jones, MD and PhD, and hold on, we're at the end of my talk, which is actually not where we're trying to get to the beginning. And so, So yes, Kamara Phyllis Jones, MD and PhD, family physician, epidemiologist, past president of the American Public Health Association, and an anti-racism thought leader. And so I did have the opportunity to present to the Select Committee on Racial Justice. And I am going to share some of the same material, tweaked a bit with you all today. So I've entitled my remarks, Achieving Societal Equity, which of course includes education equity, housing equity, health equity, you know, wealth equity, all of that. Achieving Societal Equity, Naming Racism and Moving to Action. So because I'm a family physician epidemiologist, I think I'd start you where we are, the conversation we're having about health equity, where I and now a number of others define health equity as assurance of the conditions for optimal health for all people. The key understanding there is that health equity is not something that we try to get to. We do try to get to certain outcomes. We do want to get attainment of the highest level of health for all people. But health, if we got there last Sunday, would we be done? No. Health equity is actually a process. Which process? Assurance, which is actually one of the three core functions of public health that were identified by the Institute of Medicine, along with assessment and policy development. Assurance of what? Of the conditions for optimal health for all people. How do we get there? Well, achieving health equity requires valuing all individuals and populations equally, recognizing and rectifying historical injustices, and providing resources according to need. And how is health equity related to health disparities? Well, health disparities will be eliminated when health equity is achieved. Health disparities are differences in outcomes, just like when we look at education, the so-called achievement gap, or the like. Health equity or educational equity, that's all the stuff that comes before. So I started with this definition of health equity because when we move from that to societal equity, all we have to do is actually change some words and add a little phrase. Societal equity is assurance of the conditions for optimal health and well-being for all people. And achieving societal equity requires those three principles that achieving health equity requires: valuing all individuals and populations equally, recognizing and rectifying historical injustices, and providing resources according to need, where societal disparities, educational disparities, housing disparities, and the like will be eliminated when societal equity is achieved. So that was all as a background to say that as a family physician, epidemiologist, I wish I had time to go deeply into how I got this, but as the president of the American Public Health Association, 4 years ago, I launched our association on a national campaign against racism, because racism is one of those systems of structured inequity that actually is foundational in our nation's history and continues to exist and have profoundly negative impacts on the health and well-being of the nation, that so many of us are in denial of its continued existence or impacts at all. So this national campaign against racism that I launched our American Public Health Association on, and as many other partners as would join us, actually has three tasks. The first is to name racism, to say the whole word, because if we don't, even if we're talking about cultural competence, structural competence, disparities, equity, inclusion, diversity, all those things, race, if we never say the word racism in our national context of widespread denial, then we are complicit with that denial. But we must go beyond naming racism to moving to action. How do we move to action? We need to ask the question, how is racism operating here in my child's school, in our state's schools? How is it operating in my workplace across the nation? How is it operating in terms of police killings of unarmed Black and brown men and women? How is it operating in so many ways? To identify levers for intervention, targets for action. And then once we identify those, we need to organize and strategize to act, each one in our own wheelhouse with the tools that we have, but in a coordinated way. So this is the framing. This is the framing right now. And I will say that out of that national campaign against racism that I launched APHA on in 2016, through Milwaukee County and the efforts of people in the Wisconsin Public Health Association, including Lillianne Payne in particular, and Milwaukee County being the first county to make a formal declaration in May of 2019 that racism was a public health crisis. As of December 20th, a month ago, it's the last time I looked, there were 161 jurisdictions, counties, cities, five states that had at those levels declared racism to be a public health crisis. Minnesota, amen. There you are. Big caps because at the state level, there was such a declaration. But as I said, we have to go beyond naming racism, because that is the first part. That's putting the stake in the sand, saying we as public entities recognize that racism exists and hold us accountable, public, for making action on trying to dismantle the systems of racism and its detrimental impacts. But we have to move to action. So when I talk about racism with any group, now I distill four key messages. The first is that racism exists. I'm going to give us tools. In the little 25 minutes I might have left right now, I'm going to give us tools to address all of these messages, to feel confident in understanding these messages and in communicating them to others and in acting on them. So the first is that racism exists. The second is that racism is a system. The third key message is that racism saps the strength of the whole society. And the fourth key message is that we can act to dismantle racism. And I would go further and say, we must act to dismantle racism if we want to make our society as vibrant and as strong as it could be. So the first tool I'm going to give you is one to help all of us understand and be able to communicate to others that racism exists. So I'm going to give you a heads up. I do a lot of communication through allegory. This allegory that I call Dual Reality, a Restaurant Saga, is, like most of them, based on something that I saw with my own real eyes. I hope that as I tell you this story, you will remember enough of it that you can share it with somebody in your family this evening or another colleague, or you know, even find it online and tweet it out. Anyway, so this was based on my own real life experience as a medical student. So let me set this up for you. Here I was, a first year medical student, very diligent, very studious. So on this Saturday morning, I woke up and what did I do? I hit the books and hit them hard. I was nose in the book studying, and it got to be about mid-afternoon when some friends came over. And did they distract me from my studies? Oh no, we all got to studying long and hard. So now it's getting late and we're all getting hungry, and I had no food in the apartment, which was quite typical of me. So my friends understood. They were like, never mind, Kamara, but we are hungry. Let's go into town and find something to eat. So we did. We went into town and we find a restaurant and we walk in and we sit down. The menus are presented. We order our food. The food is served. Here we are eating. Not a very illuminating story about racism. Not where you thought I was going. Not yet. But as I sat there with my friends eating, I looked across the room and I noticed a sign, and that sign was a startling revelation to me about racism. So now you are wondering, Dr. Jones, what did the sign say? Well, what did the sign say? The sign said open. So now maybe I've lost most of you. Okay, so let me recap. Here we are sitting in a restaurant eating. I look across the room, I see a sign that says open, thinking nothing more about it. I would have assumed that other people could walk in, sit down, order their food, and eat. But because of the hour, the restaurant was in fact now closed due to the hour, but so firmly closed that other hungry people, just a few feet away from me, but on the other side of that sign, would not be able to come in, sit down, order their food, and eat. And that's when I understood that racism structures open closed signs in our society, that racism structures a dual reality. And for those who are sitting inside the restaurant at the table of opportunity eating, and they look up and they see a sign that says open, they don't even recognize that there's a two-sided sign going on, because it is difficult for any of us to recognize a system of inequity that privileges us. So for example, it's difficult for men to recognize male privilege and sexism. it's difficult for white Americans to recognize white privilege and racism. It's difficult for all Americans to recognize our American privilege in the global context. But those on the outside are very well aware that there's a two-sided sign going on. And I'm so sorry, I know I have to, let me just move this thing out of the way because you can't see some of my words. Okay, there you go now. But those on the outside are very well aware that there's a two-sided sign going on because it proclaims closed to them, but they can look through the window and see people inside eating. So back inside the restaurant, to those who ask, is there really a two-sided sign? Does racism really exist? I say, I know it's hard for you to know when you only see open. In fact, that's part of your privilege, not to have to know. But once you do know, you can choose to act. So it's not a scary thing to name racism. It's actually an empowering thing. It doesn't even compel you to act, but it does equip you to act so that if you care about those on the other side of the sign, which is an if, but if you do, well, you could even talk to the restaurant owner who is, after all, inside with you. And you could say, restaurant owner, there are hungry people outside. Why don't you open the door? Let them come in. You'll make more money and all the conversations we could have. Or maybe what you'll do is try to pass food through the window. Or maybe you'll try to tear down that sign or break through the door. But at least what you won't be doing is sitting back saying, huh, wonder why those people don't just come on in and sit down and eat. Because you'll understand something about the two-sided nature of that sign. So I tell this story when I just have 4 or 5 minutes with a group to convey that, yes, racism exists, even if your whole life experience has screamed open, right? And it's not just the sign. Of course, it's the sign, it's the door, it's the lock, it's the whole system. I am actually heartened that many people who were born inside the restaurant, because some, you know, I once started a 3-hour conversation with a question with a group in Flint, Michigan. What? How could people who are born inside the restaurant know something about the two-sided nature of that sign? It was a 3-hour conversation because there are many ways to know. We're not going to go there now unless maybe you have questions about that later. But there are more people inside the restaurant now who got a little sense that there's a two-sided sign going on. It really happened starting with the COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate impact on communities of color, and then with the very public murder of Mr. George Floyd, right? So there are more people who understand there's a two-sided sign going on. There are more people who are putting together the word systemic racism or structural racism. There are more people who are affirming that Black lives matter. This is important. You know, before they say, oh, well, don't those people know that all lives matter? Yes, but Black lives matter. Black lives matter too. In particular, we have to hold that up. We have to affirm that into being. My fear right now is that because racism denial is so seductive in our society, that if all we do is name racism, say those words, then we might be lulled back in a few months into what I describe as the somnolence, the sleepiness of racism denial. We must move into action, because if we're acting, then we won't forget why we're acting. If we just say a thing, we might forget why we said that. But if we're busy tearing down the door or dismantling the lock or taking, you know, taking the sign off, all of that, we won't forget why we do that. So we must, I'm encouraged, but we must move to action. Right about now, I know I need to define racism for you all. I've been saying the words a lot. I told you that's what my work is on these days. And when I say the word racism, first of all, I'm clear that I'm talking about a system, right? I am never trying to divide the room into who's racist and who's not, or peer deeply into anybody's soul to say exactly how racist are you. No. When I say the word racism, I'm talking about a system, not an individual character flaw, not a personal moral failing, not even a psychiatric illness, as some people have suggested, even though racism can manifest in those ways. But it's a system of power, and a system of doing what? It's a system of doing two things, of structuring opportunity and assigning value. And on what basis is the opportunity structured, and on what basis is the value assigned? It's based on so-called race, based on the social interpretation of how one looks in a race-conscious society. And this system, hold on, sorry, I know you hear my dings. Let me stop this. Yeah. And what are the impacts of this system? Well, when we do think about racism or talk about racism at all, we understand that It unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities, but it shouldn't take us long to recognize that every unfair disadvantage has its reciprocal unfair advantage, so that racism is also unfairly advantaging other individuals and communities. That's the whole issue of unearned white privilege that we hardly ever talk about in this country, because it makes some people, especially some people who are living as white, uncomfortable. And I used to apologize when I would get to this part of my definition and say, well, you know, maybe I even made you uncomfortable. I don't want to make anybody uncomfortable. I want to invite everybody into this conversation. But I used to apologize and say, well, just shake it off. I don't say that anymore. I say, if you feel uncomfortable thinking about or understanding or acknowledging unearned white privilege, I actually encourage you to lean into that discomfort, because I have come to recognize that for all of us, the edge of our comfort is actually our growing edge. But there's a third impact of racism that many of us miss, and that is that racism is sapping the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. It's not just that Black Lives Matter, for example, it's that Black lives are genius. They're, you know, they're leadership, their creativity, their generosity and love. And when we constrain, and you guys know in terms of educational policy, when we constrain Black lives and Latinx lives and Indigenous lives and Asian Pacific Islander lives and Native Hawaiian, you know, lives and all of these racialized lives, when we constrain those lives slowly by not vigorously investing in the full excellent public education of all of our children, because the blinders of racism have made some people think there's no genius in the barrios or the ghettos or on the reservations. We can get along very well, thank you, without those kids. Of course, we have to recognize there's genius in all of our communities. And if we were only to fully and vigorously invest in that genius, we could be doing so much better as a nation or even as a world. I don't want to stay on this point long. I could stay in any of my points, you know, 10 minutes on any given thing. And I know I just have a little bit of time, but I do want to say that I've hit now the second and third of the key messages. The first key message was that racism exists. The second is that racism is a system. The third is that racism saps the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. And I think even more evident to us these days is through dividing people one from another, and even dividing some people from their own interests. The fourth point is that we can act to dismantle racism, and in fact, we must. And so I want to just quickly share with you another framework and my Gardner's Tale allegory, to help us understand how does racism get into the body? How does racism get into the schools? You know, how does racism get into our housing? How does racism turn into these differential societal outcomes that we see? And so I, 21 years ago now, published a paper in the American Journal of Epidemiology where I talked about three levels of racism: institutionalized, which I now would call structural; personally mediated, which some people call interpersonal, but I am so clear that racism is a system. This is the system mediated through people. So that's why I call it personally mediated, and internalized. So I'm gonna very quickly define these levels of racism for you, how they can impact health or education and the like. I'm just gonna really hit them very lightly, but I need to tell you the story that can help us all understand where we should go from here. So institutionalized or structural racism is the system, if you will, it's the structures, policies, practices, norms, and values that taken together result in differential access to the goods, services, and opportunities of society by race. This is the kind of racism that's been institutionalized in our norms and, you know, laws and policies and the like, and it doesn't require an identifiable perpetrator. It shows up often as inherited disadvantage or as reciprocal inherited advantage. We see it in terms of material conditions and in terms of access to power. So often when I'm talking about health, I say, you know, look at examples in terms of differential access to quality housing or excellent educational opportunities or equal employment opportunities or even the same level of income at the same level of employment. And I usually talk about those things impacting health. Well, we can go all around and mix it all up, because all of these things impact education and the like. Health impacts education, housing. These are all one big knot, right? These are the so-called social determinants of health, right? But so on and on, medical facilities, educational facilities, all of these things, this is how we see institutionalized racism or structural racism. We even see it in terms of access to power, power as information. Information about our full histories, right? This is very much about curriculum and the like, for people to know their full histories. That's power. You know, if, you know, access to power as resources, not just capital resources, but social networking resources. Power as voice in government, media, and the like. And I'm so happy to be speaking to you all in state government. This is a real privilege. So I really look forward to your questions to me. Sometimes on the health side of things, people have challenged me and said, well, housing, education, employment, income, isn't that what we call social class? So why do you have that on a slide about racism? Are you talking about racism or are you really talking about social class? Such an important question. I usually go into a lot of depth about this, but the short response is that it doesn't just so happen that some folks, that communities of color in most parts of the United States are overrepresented in poverty while white folks are overrepresented in wealth. It's not just a happenstance. And there are historical injustices, initial historical injustices that set it up, their contemporary structural factors that are perpetuating those initial historical injustices. Initial historical injustices, including the taking for American Indians or Alaska Natives, the taking of the land and the near genocide and moving people to reservations, reserved lands. For people of African descent, it includes the kidnapping of West African people, our importation across the Atlantic with tremendous loss of life. And then for centuries, for the survivors and their progeny going forward, centuries of usury of our unpaid labor to build this country. I usually go into a lot of depth. I just have to say that all of these things are perpetuated, the initial historical injustices are perpetuated by present-day contemporary structural factors, which are part and parcel of institutionalized or structural racism. For example, how we fund public schools in most part of this country based on local property taxes, which means if you have a poor community, you can have poorly funded schools, most often poor educational outcomes, and another generation lost, or another generation with these frontline essential jobs pushed into the fray, even in terms of the COVID-19 that we're seeing right now. So when people ask me, am I talking about social class or racism, I say that institutionalized or structural racism explains why we see an association between social class and race in this country at all. I also need to say that structural racism can be through acts of doing, as well as acts of not doing, acts of commission, as well as acts of omission. And very often we see structural racism as lack of action, inaction in the face of need. The second level of racism I describe as personally mediated racism. I define as differential assumptions about the abilities, motives, and intents of others by race, and then differential actions. Based on those assumptions, this is what most people think of when they hear the word racism. Somebody did something to somebody. It includes the different idea, the prejudice, and the different action, the discrimination. Many ways that this can manifest, including teacher devaluation, teacher looking at a young child and thinking that child can't learn and putting them off in the attention deficit disorder track, where that child will never even know their full potential, much less have the opportunity to develop to their full potential. Like structural racism, this level can be through acts of doing as well as acts of not doing. But even more important at this level is to recognize that personally mediated racism can be unintentional as well as intentional. That is, you do not have to have intended to do something racist to have had a racist impact. The third level of racism, internalized racism, I'm defining here from point of view of members of stigmatized races as acceptance by members of stigmatized races of negative messages about our own abilities and intrinsic worth. Sorry. Hold on for just a sec. This manifests as self-devaluation, people of color feeling maybe I'm really not as good as, maybe I shouldn't try to graduate from high school, maybe I shouldn't try to get that job, live in that neighborhood. And it turns into the white man's Isis Calder syndrome, which is a phrase that I heard from my parents and their generation. And what it meant back then for people of color, it still means for many of us today. And that is, say I'm black and I need a doctor, I might actually seek out a white doctor over a black doctor. Or I might, if I needed a lawyer, seek out a white lawyer over a black lawyer. Or if my water were cold, were warm, and I needed ice, I might go way down the street to get the white man's ice over the black man's ice, deeply believing that the white man's ice is colder, deeply internalizing the myth of white superiority. And it shows up as resignation and helplessness and hopelessness, which turns into a lot of self-destructive health behaviors. It's about members of stigmatized races accepting the limitations to our own full humanity of the box into which we've been placed. So that when we hear young high school students of color, and one of them's trying to be the valedictorian, and the friends are teasing her or him by saying, oh, you know, so-and-so, she's just trying to be white, we need to challenge that, because since when did white people claim exclusive access to excellence? They did not. So I would like to, I know that I was trying to be within half an hour. I can stay, Representative Richardson. How much more time can I have to tell this story and then just share a few more ideas?
You can go for another 5 or 6 minutes. That'll be fine.
Okay, thank you so much. This is going to be my gardener's tale allegory. I actually am going to stop sharing my screen so that you can see me big, because I'm going to use my my hands a lot. This story was based on something that happened to in my own real life, but I'm going to jump to the essence of the story. Let's just say that in my own real life, I saw that the quality of the soil matters, right? When you're planting plants, the quality of the soil matters. So now I'm going to start with an image of a gardener who has two flower boxes, one which she knows to have rich, fertile soil, and one which she knows to have poor, rocky soil. And she has seed for the same kind of flowers, except that some of the seed is going to produce pink blossoms and some of the seed is going to produce red blossoms. And this gardener prefers red over pink. So what does she do? She takes the red seed and puts it in the rich, fertile soil, the pink seed in the poor, rocky soil. And 3 weeks later, she sees what I actually had seen in my own garden, but I hadn't done it on purpose. She sees that in the rich, fertile soil, all the red seed has sprouted. And the strong red seed has grown very tall and vigorous, but even the weak red seed makes it halfway up. But in that poor rocky soil, the weak pink seed planted in that poor rocky soil dies, but even the strong pink seed in the poor rocky soil has to struggle to make it to a middling height. And then in those two flower boxes, those flowers go to seed, right? And the next year, the same thing happens. And then those flowers go to seed. And year after year after year after year, the same thing happens until finally about 10 years later, the gardener is looking at her flower boxes and she says, you know, I was right to prefer red over pink. So I hope I said that she preferred red over pink in the beginning. It's been a long time. When I get in the middle, okay. She says, I was right to prefer red over pink. So let's stop the story right there to say the first part of this story is how structural or institutionalized racism works, where you have the initial historical injustice of the separation of the seed into the two types of soil. You had the contemporary structural factors of the flower boxes keeping the soil separate, and then through lack of action, inaction in the face of the perpetuation of the inequity. But let's pick the story back up to say, well, where would personally mediated racism be in this garden? Well, the gardener's looking over at red, thinking, oh, red is so beautiful. And then she looks at the pink flowers and she says, oh, those pink flowers sure are scrawny and scraggly. So she plucks off the pink blossoms before they can even go to seed. Or maybe she notices that a pink seed has blown into the rich, fertile soil. So she plucks it out before it can establish itself, which is some of the anti-affirmative action stuff that goes on. And where would internalized racism be in the garden? Well, the red flowers are just living their lives, enjoying being red. You know, many of them not acknowledging or perhaps not even recognizing that they're benefiting from enriched soil. Pink flowers looking over at red thinking red is mighty fine and wishing with all their hearts that they too could be red. And here come the bees minding their own business, collecting nectar, but pollinating at the same time. So here comes a bee into one of the pink flowers and then to another pink flower and to this pink flower. And that flower's like, get away from me, bee. Don't bring me any of that pink pollen. I prefer the red, because the pink flower has internalized that red is better than pink. So now the question arises, what do we do to set things right in this garden? Well, we could start out by addressing the internalized racism. We can go over to the pink flowers and say, pink is beautiful, power to the pink. That is an important intervention, but if that's all we do, it's not going to change the situation in which the pink flowers find themselves. So you might say, okay, well, let's address the personally mediated racism. Let's have a conversation with the gardener, or better yet, let's have a workplace multicultural workshop for the gardener, right? So we do all that, And we say, dear gardener, would you please stop plucking those pink flowers? And maybe she will, and maybe she won't. But even if she does, it's not going to change the situation in which the pink flowers find themselves. If we really want to set things right in this garden, we must address the structural racism, which means we have to either break down the boxes and mix up the soil, or if we want to keep separate boxes, that's all right too, although it makes it easier for that same gardener to keep segregating resources going forward. But if we want to keep separate boxes, it means we have to enrich the poor rocky soil until it is as rich as the rich fertile soil. And when we do that, the pink flowers will flourish. They'll be looking beautiful, grand, and glorious. So that in the intervention on the structural racism, we will have also addressed the internalized racism, because pink will no longer be looking over at red, thinking that red is better or wanting to be red. And in the intervention of the structural, we may also address the personally mediated racism. Now, the original gardener may have to go to her grave preferring red over pink, but her children who grow up and see the flowers equally beautiful will be less likely to have that same kind of attitude. So this story has been to illustrate those three levels of racism and to strongly suggest that if we want to set things right in the garden, we need to at least address the structural racism. Good to address all the levels at the same time, but at least address the structural. And when we do, the other levels may take care of themselves. I hope I did justice to the story, shortening it so much. But anyway, I hope you understood. But here's an important question we haven't asked, which is, who is the gardener? Because after all, the gardener is the one that I gave the power to decide, the power to act, and control of resources, which are actually the elements of self-determination. You know, who's the gardener? Well, government's a huge part of the gardener. Here you guys are, but not all, you know, so, you know, there are other parts like, you know, companies or media, you know, communities to the extent they have self-determination, but whoever the gardener is, it is dangerous when the gardener is not allied with one group. I painted her red, that's why she preferred red over pink. And it's also dangerous when she's not concerned with equity, when she can look at her flower boxes and think, you know, that her garden is beautiful because she's not even counting the pink flowers as part of her garden. So our challenge now is, what do we do about the gardener? Do we make the gardener polka dotted, or striped, or fuchsia? Do the pink flowers have to grow and recruit their own gardener? Lots of questions can come out of this, and I hope that we would have time to that. I just want to go quickly through the last slides. I just want to say that I've given you tools for naming racism, two allegories, in fact, but we have to go to that next step, which is asking, how is racism operating here? Looking at our structures, policies, practices, norms, and values, which are the elements of decision-making. Structures are the who, what, when, and where of decision-making. Especially who's at the table and who's not, what's on the agenda and what's not. Bravo to you all for putting anti-racism on your agenda right now. And if structures are the who, what, when, and where of racism, policies are the written how, practices and norms are the unwritten how, and values are the why. I need to say that I've identified seven kind of values-based things. I now call them social delusions that are barriers to our achieving health equity. So I'm just gonna hit them a little bit. Our narrow focus on the individual makes systems and structures either invisible or irrelevant. The fact that we are ahistorical and act as if the present were disconnected from the past, and as if the current distribution of advantage and disadvantage were happenstance, it's also a barrier to achieving health equity. The myth of meritocracy, the story that goes something like this: if you work hard, you'll make it. I give you most people who have made it have worked hard, but there are many, many other people working just as hard or harder who will never make it because of an uneven playing field that's been structured and perpetuated by racism and sexism and heterosexism and all of these other systems of structure inequity. And when we deny racism, then we're buying into the myth of meritocracy. We're blaming people for their lack of success by saying they're lazy or stupid. And there are many ways to deny racism. As I said at the beginning, one way to deny racism is to never say the word racism. Because if you never say the word racism in the context of widespread racism denial, we're complicit. There's this myth of a zero-sum game. If I gain, I lose. It's almost like you're sitting at a potluck dinner and you know, I'm here and I don't want you to come over and eat because I think you're gonna eat all the food up. I don't recognize you're bringing all kinds of cakes and pies and salads and fruits and delicious things with you. I don't even value you. There's our limited future orientation, which must really burn at you all who are in the Education Policy Committee. Because in this nation, we actually have a disregard for the children, which is one part of the future we can touch today, and a usurious relationship with the planet, which is another part of the future that we can touch today. We do not recognize that it's not my children versus your children, that all children are our children. I wish I could go into more detail on these things. I don't have the time. The sixth of these seven barriers is our myth of American exceptionalism, that we're so special, so ordained by God, so unique that there's nothing we can learn from other nations. And the seventh is white supremacist ideology, which I do not say as a lightning rod term. I say it as a simple description of the false idea of a hierarchy of human valuation by race, with the falser notion that even if such a hierarchy existed, that would put white people at the top as the ideal or the norm. But this false idea, which is staunchly held by many in this country, it permeates so much of our media and so much of our everything. So much of, I would have to say, what happened on January 6th in terms of even the police response. But that gives people who are living as white a sense of entitlement. It results in the dehumanization of people of color and the fear at the browning of America that's underlying a lot of our political divide today. So what can we do today? First of all, we need to look for evidence of two-sided signs. Is there something differential going on in our educational system, in our outcomes and all, by race, by language, by immigration status, by zip code, by urban, rural? Look, shine the bright light of inquiry. We need to burst through our bubbles of experience to experience our common humanity. We're all in bubbles. Some are big, some are little, some have thin soap bubble boundaries, some have thick, but whatever kind of bubble you're living in, you know, me, all of us are living in, we often do not know that just across town, there are people who are just as kind, funny, generous, hardworking, and smart as we are, who are living in very different circumstances. We need to create opportunities within our educational systems and within our own lives for people to burst through their bubbles, to experience our common humanity in different settings, because that in that way we can build common cause. We need to be interested in the stories of others and then believe the stories of others and then join in the stories of others. We need to develop a sensitivity to seeing the absence of who is not at the table, what is not on the agenda. We need to reveal inaction in the face of need, because that is how structural racism most often manifests today. But all the power is not just on those who are inside the restaurant, because those of us on the outside need to know our power. We need to recognize that action is power, and particularly that collective action is power. So I'm so sorry that I went over time, but I'm so delighted to have this opportunity to share these thoughts. I hope they have stimulated some ideas or at least questions in your mind. So thank you very much.
Dr. Jones, thank you for your very powerful testimony.
Thank you, Chair Richardson and Ms. Taken-Holsey, for providing us with that video of Dr. Jones's earlier presentation to the Education Policy Committee. It's much appreciated. It's an interesting delivery form of approach from a someone who's been a college professor, the telling of stories and drawing us in, as opposed to the more dry technical sort of approaches that I mostly got when I was in college from my professor. So much appreciated way to draw us in. Representative Richardson, did you want to sum up anything or speak to that video?
Thank you, Chair Dabney, for the opportunity to share Dr. Jones's information today. I think it just helps to have a bit of a foundation, knowing that there's going to be quite a bit of discussion around equity issues, because it's something that is really important to many of the folks that are members of the committee today, and just thought it would be a nice grounding. So appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Next on the agenda, members, we'll hear from Dr. Bruce Corey, a local economist, who is going to help us put into context how structural racism is impacting our economy and the role that education can play in mitigating that impact. Professor Corey, welcome to the committee. Appreciate your time today. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Bruce Corey. I am a professor of economics and a community economist with the Lana Brain Trust. I am a professor of economics at Concordia University in St. Paul, and it's an incredible honor to be invited here to share some insights with this committee. So I want to thank Chair Richardson, Chair Chamberlain, and others on this committee for this. I don't claim to have the philosopher's stone, but I like to have the boots on the ground approach, where talking and engaging with ordinary people that can get the insights that we need to do to have this change that is very much needed. And all of us have been coming through this very, especially our kids, the tough time through these months of COVID, and then the civil reckoning and searching that happened in the many months since the murder of George Floyd, and now we are here. I want to commend the committee for grounding this discussion on who we are as Minnesotans. The other thing I'm excited about being in this today is the fact that when I read the omnibus education bill, I find the elements of a new playbook for education policy in the state and funding in the state, a comprehensive approach that I would share with you a little later. I have over three decades of experience as an educator, engaging with other countries in the world too. And I also have children that have gone through both the public school system as well as the religious Catholic school system in Minnesota. And so what I share is also part of the lived experience in the state. So I'll bring in my presentation by talking through the what we call the Minnesota solution to reduce racial educational disparities. When we have to start at the core, as Dr. Jones was sharing, in the historical footprint of racism in the state, and it's so well documented in these maps, historical maps of what we call the redlining maps, where the contours of economic and educational success were defined around geographical bounds. The video that the previous speaker pointed out, something that's open and something that's closed. So the people in the red line area had that sign closed, that they could not venture out and they could not move and access the mobility, economic and educational mobilities, and were stuck in these poverty-ridden, low-worth neighborhoods in terms of those economic assets. And so these footprints remain today in these covenants that have been identified and shared, and shows how the roots of what we have today are rooted in these kinds of things that we call the system. As a point of reference, when I talk about the Alana communities, African, Latino, Asian, and Native American communities, it helped me bring focus on who I'm talking about, the Alana people, but also it moves away from something that I do not like to be called, and that is a person of color, because color is one of the ways in which racism manifests itself, and the system of racism of classifying people in a fraction of a second around a color and moving you into a track of where you cannot get out of it. And that's one of my first ways to break out of that system. So the collective impact historically on racism and systems of racism over time gets reflected in these economic outcomes. And so we can see these economic outcomes in the racial income gap. Black earns 71 cents of the dollar compared to whites. We see it in the racial education gap. There's a 21% gap in the six-year graduation rates between blacks and whites. We see the racial housing gap. There's a 53% homeownership gap between black and white. And we see it in the racial investment gap in the form of this very tiny Alana firm businesses in Minnesota in terms of their revenue. So over time, we begin to see these disparities accumulate and grow such that we have the unfortunate recognition of being a state that has some of the worst disparities evident. Nationally, Citibank got a lot of attention to this report that they did in quantifying the economic impacts of racism and showing the loss to the country that this endures. So for example, if you just close the black income gap, we would add $2.7 trillion in income, or about 0.2% of GDP into this country. So what a very powerful economic engine would emerge when we do the right things and we do it well. And so if we close the education gap, we would then have about $9 to $113 billion of additional lifetime earnings in our communities that could generate the next innovator, the next creator, the next artist. So I went locally and looked at all these different gaps, the housing gap, the income gap, the entrepreneurship gap, the education gap, that means the lifetime earnings of someone at a particular educational level, and estimated that this combined economic loss to Minnesota would be somewhere on the range of $287 billion. As a point of reference, $287 billion is bigger than the economy of Chile. That whole country, a very vibrant economy, but that's the magnitude of the cost, but also the magnitude of the benefit that Minnesota would get by removing these barriers to success. And Minnesota also is losing revenue to as much as $2 billion a year because of this loss in income and loss in assets. So it's important that we address this issue and address these issues well. I also want to point out something of a personal nature too, is that when the judicial panel defined the legislative districts in 1919 and 2000, I presented on behalf of a multi-ethnic network called 1MN.org. I presented to the judicial panel and asked them to have adequate representation of the Alana interests in the legislature, in our political bodies across the state. And so the system that was constructed by the panel, we have 125 legislative districts in Minnesota, which have at least $100 million in these Alana economic interests. 85% of the Senate, 51% of the House have these interests very clearly defined. And together they have the votes to pass any legislation that is important, that is needed, and that can be timely. And we can have a list of these complete on the links that are on these slides. I want to begin by saying that if we want to address the issue about disparities, we've got to change the way we think and how we look at our communities. And I want you to look at these children that you represent in this committee as a $1.5 trillion asset. That means if every one of our about a half a million youth in our school and university system, if every one of them got a bachelor's degree, their lifetime earnings would be $1.5 trillion. And that is bigger than the economy of Mexico. So that's the value of the assets that you're deliberating right now in this committee on how to shape the future. And what you do here today is going to be, in this session, is going to be having dramatic impacts for the future. What I want to offer based on my experience, as I mentioned, over these past decades, is a framework in which comprehensive framework to determine the success of our Alana BIPOC students. So these four elements are one, funding, which should be important in terms of both scope and scale. The number, the kinds of support services that are available for our youth, whether it's mental health or wellness, whether it is career counseling, whether it is health, whether it is academic support. We need this infrastructure to help what Dr. Jones mentioned, how encouraging and helping this individual break out these structures that they have been put into and achieve academic success. And then we need to have a system, a learning environment that's culturally intelligent. We know from our experience in the workplace how when someone gets a connect to the material or to their job, then they become motivated, energized, creative, innovative. And that environment is what our youth need in their classroom. a curriculum that reflects and appreciates and values, because very often they've come through decades of people not valuing their culture as important and their experience as important. So we need that cultural intelligence in the classroom, but we also need the representation in teachers and staff and administrators. And this, and the curriculum, and this points to the issue of power. We have to have shared governance and shared power, because if you have resources without power and the sharing of power, it's not going to happen. In this legislative session, I've heard people like Chair Moran talk about better butter in the batter, of how we need to have people whom we are working with be part of the solution. And unless we address issues of power and governance and institutions, resources that we put are not going to be effectively utilized within the system. And finally, we need to have an academic and career outcomes focus. How are we doing? And asking the questions, how are we doing? But also when we ask the question, we need to break it down, disaggregate it by different Alana groups. For instance, even among the Asian community, if we point out the relative better performance of Asians in the academic sphere nationally, it might be misleading, because when you look at the more than 40 different cultural groups within the Asian category, you'd find that some newer refugees, for instance, are struggling and need a very particular focused attention in order to get to achieve economic success. So disaggregated data, breaking it down, but also asking the question, how are we doing on graduation day? How are we doing in outcomes, in placement? What kinds of jobs are our, what kind of majors are us, are our youth getting into, and keeping that focus? So within this perspective, if I were to look at the Omnibus E12 Education Bill and ask the question, how well is it doing in terms of this core framework? In terms of investments, I see a lot of very good investments happening in multiple areas. But in terms of scale and scope, when I add it up, including integration funding, which is one of the biggest amount of $160 million, I believe, it's just 1.2% of total E-12 spending. That's my understanding. At the same time, our Alana students make up 35% of the total school population. And we got to think about, even though that each one of that student is bringing revenue with them to a school or to a school district, to a city, to a state, and what are we doing to invest in that student that we are serving? And so if I were to look at a proportionate investment in the Alana students, given the reality of the racial experience that they have experienced historically, in scale and scope, we would think we'd at least need $1 billion of very targeted, focused investments to make this happen. And there could be multiple ways to achieve this level of investment without necessarily being $1 billion new amount of investment, but also how well the existing investments are also being actively spent. When we look at multi-tiered support, we find that I find a lot of various areas that have been invested in significant ways, and we've got to look at that in relevant to the need that is out there. Because in the earlier introductions that happened, I was happy to hear members of this committee from Austin and Albert Lee and Bemidji and Maplewood and a wide range of our young people are across the state and across, and in many areas they need the kind of support that that is important for them. This bill also includes many areas where cultural intelligence needs to be affirmed and encouraged, not only in the curriculum, but also in terms of increasing representation, like the teachers of color a very small fraction of the total number of teachers in the system. The bill, I believe, says a 2% increase in teachers of color a year, which I personally think is too small, because all of us would be way past our prime before we actually begin to see the change that happened that we need to see happening. The bills talk about how school districts and school plans and individual schools and school principals, how all of these elements can have better representation and better integration, which is something that is really needed and important. And finally, I see the emphasis on disaggregated data to assess program and youth outcomes and graduation rates, which again is very important. So in conclusion, I see the new playbook emerging from this omnibus bill, a comprehensive framework and strategy to address racial and educational disparities. I see it needs more funding than the amount that is out here if we really want to make a dent. And what we see is, we also know is that the legislative leaders, the governors, and school leadership have a very decisive opportunity today. 25 years from now, when our children and grandchildren look back and say, okay, what happened after when COVID hit Minnesota and when the murder of George Floyd and the whole society woke up in concern about what's going on? What did they do? How did they invest? What did we see different compared to the last time it happened? And I think when you look at this element of the bill, and if these elements are strengthened and invested and implemented, you will begin to see that $1.5 trillion asset emerge in making and building a Minnesota that works for everyone. Thank you for this opportunity to share these insights.
Chair Devin, you're muted.
Thank you, Ms. Burt. Thank you, Dr. Corey. Members, any questions for Dr. Corey? Please feel free to use the raise your hand function as the first choice. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, just a clarification question. I missed what the acronym ALANA, how that works and what it stands for.
Dr. Corey.
Chair Devney, Representative Pryor. It's a new word. It is African, Latino, Asian, Native American. It names the people, but the interesting part is it also gives priority to the people most impacted by racism historically, people of African descent and Native American. And it helps provide the focus on who we're talking about.
Representative Pryor?
Thank you. That was my question. Thank you, Dr. Corey. Thank you for the presentation.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, Dr. Corey, thank you for the challenge you placed before the conference committee. Much appreciated. Thank you for returning to the committee as well. Members, moving along, we wanted to take from the broad discussions we've been having down to the concrete and practical level of school districts. And I believe North St. Paul Maplewood has been mentioned a couple of times today already, but we're lucky enough to have Superintendent Christine Tucci Osorio with us today. We're going to start with a video of a presentation that she did before the House last year when we did a day-long symposium on the opportunity gap and racial disparities. But then she will be joining us for questions, so we're looking forward to that. Ms. Burt, if you could shift us over to the video from Superintendent Tucci Osorio, that'd be great. Thank you.
With the North St. Paul Maplewood
School District and Superintendent Osorio on the initiatives that she has implemented to deal with the racial disparities in her district and an exploration of that and the costs associated with that. This is a variation perhaps on a presentation that she gave to Commissioner Ricker's working group on education finance in Minnesota a month or so ago?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Right. Thank you, Representative Dabney, and to all of the representatives here today and others. First of all, I on the fly just decided that I'm going to bring Aisha and Ashley up here since they were just suddenly introduced to the group. They weren't expecting that today, but I wanted to just share for a moment that part of what's really special about the relationship with our students, Aisha and Ashley are a couple of students who were really involved in our the big student conference that we had, the Metro-wide student conference back in October. We had students from all over the metropolitan area, about 1,500 students, bringing together student voice. If you are aware of it, if you haven't seen the videos, I would encourage you to check it out. We also have my son and his friend, which is Sweeney, here as well, and students from all over the metro who were connected. And just last night, Ashley and Aisha and I were on a Zoom chat with each other. We've been exploring this idea of teleconferencing and how do we get students connected across within our district and across districts. And we are actually planning a project to reach out to students in greater Minnesota and try to get kids talking to each other to break down isolation and improve conversations of the student voice and leadership, not only within the metro, but throughout the state of Minnesota. And our two young ladies sitting with me were all over this idea last night through a virtual conference we were having about how we might go about doing that. So be looking for these two. They're going to be doing some really amazing things in the very near future. So, and apparently it's kind of like a payday today for them as well because of the initiative they took to show up today and sit at lunch today and have some amazing conversations. So that's pretty exciting. So I thought, get up here and sit up here. So I just wanted to get started that way. So as Representative Dabney just explained, he had asked me to come today and give a little reprise of a presentation that I did earlier in the winter to the State Task Force on School Finance. You may have heard that the governor's organized a task force to start looking at how we might unpack our current system of school finance in the state of Minnesota. The group, I'm actually co-chairing this group with Sherry Johnson, who is a special education leader in a collaborative in the Red Wing area. And what we're trying to do is take a look. We have representatives from many different organizations, the PTA, Education Minnesota, PACER, as well as many different professional organizations from around the state, taking a look at our current school finance system. And if you want to take a look at something so complicated as our school finance system, everybody has their own perspective. Everybody thinks it's broken, and everybody has a different reason why they think it's broken. It reminded me a lot of our first meeting of an ancient Indian parable. I don't know if you've ever heard about this, of the six blind men and the elephant. It's a very ancient Indian parable. And it goes something like this, where they all are describing how they feel this elephant to be, and they all have a different feeling of what their part of the elephant feels like. And when each other describes it, they all think the other person is being dishonest and actually come to blows with each other because they think the other person's lying about what the elephant is supposedly looks or feels like, because everybody's got their own perspective. So the way we approach this state finance task force is to every month take a lens into what is the experience for each district around the state. We've taken different topics such as the special education cross-subsidy. We brought together a metro district and a rural district. We brought together the topic of EL funding. We brought together a rural district and a metro district. Come tell us your case study, your story. We brought together the topic, in this case, of cost of closing the achievement gap. We brought together, in this occasion, my district, and we brought together East Grand Forks. We were the two presenters that night. So we're trying to just give different lenses into what this story looks like throughout our different lenses of the financial system that we have for education funding in Minnesota. So this is a reprise of that. So I want to just be clear, it's not all state funding. This is not the achievement gap. It's just a little story of some of the things that we spend money on in Minnesota as we take our efforts to try to close our achievement gap, or the opportunity gap, as we like to call it. So with that, I'm just going to jump into some of the information I have. We always like to begin with the educational disparities. I don't need to get into that today. I love that, you know, when I gave this presentation at that school finance task force that night, I was also the last person on the agenda that night, and I'd also run out of time, so I spoke a million miles a minute, and so I will do that again for you, because
Thankfully, you don't have any windows in here, but it is glorious outside right now. So I will do my best to shorten this up and keep it sweet, but you guys don't need to know more about the achievement gap in our test scores because you see it every day. But they're there, and you can take a look at the slide deck a little more closely later if you want to dig into that. But I also want to reiterate the economic disparities. I know you know about this, but some of these things are just incredibly powerful. That, you know, for every 100,000 Minnesotans, there were 111 white people incarcerated and 1,219 black people incarcerated. This is a couple years old. I don't doubt that it's changed very much since then. But I just like to bring that out and the economic impact, not only for education, but just our sheer workforce shortage that we're facing in the state of Minnesota that's only going to continue to grow. So it really is an economic issue for us in the state as well. I always like to, whenever I give a presentation, remind people a little bit about our district. You hear North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale. We're North St. Paul, but we're actually east of St. Paul. We're not actually north of St. Paul. Don't know why. You know, it's kind of one of those funny things. We're North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, and a little slice of Woodbury, tiny, tiny bit of Lake Elmo, Pine Springs. But we're actually a very diverse school district. Our demographics, we're just under 11,000 students. We are 54% free and reduced, 65.4% students of color. You can see our special education rate's pretty high. This is a comparison of us and Minneapolis Public Schools. So you can see we're very, very similar. We liken ourselves pretty much to Minneapolis Public Schools. We also often talk about how we and Bloomington are twin districts. They also do the same. In fact, we are constantly chasing each other's data. They're actually similar in size to us as well. I've got some test score data comparisons for our district. You can look more closely at that with more time. I like to pull up our finances. And the reason I highlighted the three columns in the middle, and I know in our colleagues in Greater Minnesota, and I have many conversations, they go, oh my gosh, look at all the comp ed money you get in the Title I and equity and integration funding. It is a lot of money. And if you look at our overall budget, you can see that our total amount of comp ed, Title I, and equity integration, the reason I highlighted those three funds is because typically those are some funds that you might dedicate towards closing an opportunity gap, right? Comp ed dollars are directed towards students in poverty, same for Title I, and your equity and integration is dedicated towards improving racial integration and integration of economics as well. And so those are three buckets of money that you would typically spend to invest on those areas. Now I want to show you our cross-subsidy. For those, I know we've got some students in the room, cross-subsidy is basically the money that you spend in addition to what you get for that bucket of funding. So for special education, you've got certain expense areas that you need to spend for special education requirements. We spend an additional $14 million to meet our expectations for special education funding. And for EL funding, we get a certain amount of dollars for EL services, and we spend an additional 1.2. So that $15 million that you might think about we get in those extra funds is gone when you think about our cost subsidy. Now, I want to be really clear. Our EL students and our special education students are also our regular ed students. And I think too often we forget that they are also getting all of our general ed services. They are not others. They are not people who don't also get regular ed services too. But I just want to put those into those funding streams so that you can get a picture of that. So it's not always this additional extra funding that's also not being used because we have all these cross subsidies that we are trying to backfill for as well. So just for that perspective, as a school district of our size, we do offer very comprehensive programming like many of us around us try to do. We offer a very comprehensive early childhood programming. We try to stay very competitive. As our school district has changed demographically, we very intentionally try to stay very competitive in keeping our economic diversity and our racial diversity. It's no secret that our urban core school districts have a lot of white flight happening, and we go after that. We try to stay highly competitive. We are trying to keep our high school course catalog as rich and full as humanly possible. And we look for creative ways to keep adding experiences for our students so that we can continue to draw and stay competitive with our neighbors. We're pretty proud of actually how well we do in that. College and career readiness and college courses that are available in our high schools. But we also have a very, very large adult programming, adult GED program. We're the largest GED testing site in the state of Minnesota, larger than Minneapolis and St. Paul. So we offer a lot of opportunities in those areas. There's a growth cap in that area for funding as well. Might be putting that on your radar. But a lot of things we try to stay competitive with. So when we think about what do we try to do to close this opportunity gap for our students, right? So a couple things. We've worked really hard over the last few years to build a very strong MTSS, multi-tiered systems of support. We used to call it RTI. Remember how the buzzwords change over the time? So I'm not going to expect you to see this diagram. You can look it up later. I can talk to you about it later. It's taken quite a while. We have it pretty solid in our elementary schools. Basically, we have every child in our elementary schools is screened every 4 to 6 weeks, and we make sure that every child gets an extra 30 minutes of win time, what I need time. And during that time, we actually pay for extra additional supports. We really tap into some retired teachers who come back in and do hourly work with us so that we can provide extra reading teachers at the same time, so we can get small group instruction going on and do intervention support. We also, at that same time, try to weave in some extra math supports, but every single child, every 6 weeks, the whole team's like all of the grade level teams work at the same time. We have taken a long time to get there, but we now have it absolutely rock solid in all 9 of our elementary schools. We're not there yet for middle and high school. We've got a ways to go, but we've got it solid in our elementary schools, and I think that's part of the reason why we are in many, many ways beating the odds. I think there's been a lot of newspaper reports about how we are a district that is beating the odds with our data every year. We kind of make some news stories about that. There's costs with that. We choose to not buy other things and spend our money on some of these things because we believe they make a return on our investment. We also invest in a full-time nurse and social worker at every school. I will tell you, that's not easy to do. When I first came to the district, we didn't have time for all that, or we didn't have money for it. We had to cut some other things to make it happen. Freedom schools. We know that kids need to feel social, emotional, and cultural connections and identity in their programming. Freedom schools is more expensive than traditional summer programming. Freedom Schools is based out of the civil rights movement in the 60s, and it's very much a cultural enrichment program, high energy. If you've never been to one, you've got to check it out. Yes. Identity, a young scholars program. We also look at the traditional past to exclude our students of color. If you screen them in the traditional models for gifted programs, we go and find kids of color and make sure they get in these programs. Our data longitudinally shows that these kids actually get into high, rigorous coursework more effectively if they participate in these programs in elementary. We also invest in behavior specialists and restorative practice training. This is a training we've been doing with our bus drivers. We've been investing a lot. We actually moved this coach into the bus garage. We own our own fleet. Her office is at the bus garage. AVID, we've invested very heavily in AVID. We have 2 national demonstration sites. Late activity bus, many districts have cut that. We fight every year to hang on to it. Our kids have got to have a ride home if they're going to stay after school and be part of these interventions. The Tony Senna Foundation. I don't know if anybody's been checking on this program, but talk about return on investment. Many programs try to recruit and retain diverse staff, right? If you look around, many times your diverse staff in your buildings, they're your paraprofessionals and they're non-licensed people. Mm-hmm. We've intentionally worked on getting principals of color, assistant principals of color, and licensed teachers of color. The Tony Senna Foundation actually, for a very low cost, helps you get interns into your school and gets them on a track to a 4-year licensed teacher program to get them fully licensed at a very reasonable cost. I know the legislature has helped pay for that in the past. I highly support that. We're very excited to have that high return on investment, and it gets them fully licensed. It's time to stop looking and counting that we're doing well because our paraprofessionals and our custodians and our food service are our people of color. We got to get them in the licensed positions and in leadership positions. And then our junior ROTC, now I'm going to tell you, I used to be a flaming liberal who thought, I don't want military recruiting people in my high schools, get them out of here. I don't feel that way anymore. If you've ever watched our JROTC programs, they are a leadership program, and there are students of ours that absolutely thrive. It's catching kids who would never be hooked into sports and activities and clubs, and our kiddos in this program, they are a family. We need programs that kick kids in the whole person, whole body, whole emotionality, and they feel connected to a program that's part of their whole self is hooked into it. I absolutely 100% endorse this program, and I have seen it with my own eyes. And I've even flown up in a helicopter with these kids, and it was an amazing thing. BAR is one of the most researched programs out there. Ninth grade, teachers wrapping around kids. We've known forever if you catch kids in ninth grade and don't let them fail a class, they don't get credit deficient. Ding, ding, ding. How about we start working on that before they fail instead of waiting to send them to ALC and trying to catch them up? BAR is totally research-based, and we have seen an amazing turnaround in our data of course failure rates. Saturday school. Now, we have an amazing program at Tartan High School. It's not punitive. It's voluntary. Pick the teachers kids love. Have them come. Core classes. English. science, math, and social studies. They come, and it's optional. We had 102 kids last Saturday. Come if you want to. You need help on your homework. They come. They want help. And then we just have some district, some headlines, because we've made it in the news a few times. And I just want to emphasize one more thing we work really hard on. Our staff matter. Our staff are valued. We take a lot of time and energy to flatten the organization, share decision-making. One of our greatest interventions we ever did was came out of our kindergarten team. They decided they needed to figure it out. We don't have a director of teaching and learning. Our decisions come from our teachers and our principals. We work this stuff out together. We have very strong employee relations, strong union relationship, because we make decisions together. It's not top-down. And I'm done. How's that for really fast? Hey. It seems to be my mantra lately when I get the end of the day.
Yeah, Representative Osorio, thank you for that high level and high speed review. At the commission. So there was the high level and high speed presentation by Superintendent Osorio, but she's with us here today for bringing, I'm sure, that same energy, because every time I've seen her present, she brings that same energy and passion and commitment. So, Superintendent, thank you for taking time out of your schedule today to join the conference committee. Welcome you first to introduce yourself and summarize or share with us what you wish, and then there'll be opportunity for questions. So thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, and thank you to all the representatives here this afternoon. I feel like I'm exhausted watching that presentation. I remember that day feeling like I just needed to get every point in, and the clock was ticking and we were going to run out of time, and it was a Friday afternoon. So I promise you I will not speak that quickly today so we can hear each other a little bit better. It's just a remarkable to me that was 1 week before schools shut down, and we had no idea what was around, what was just on the horizon. And so it's really interesting to have this little flashback in time to look at what we were talking about. I said, as you know, I'm Christine Tucci Osorio. I'm the superintendent for North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale. One thing I wanted to say too, you know, that presentation was put together when we were exploring the conversation, the costs of closing the opportunity gap for schools. One of the challenges, and I'm just going to start with this right now because I know there's a lot of conversation right now with the legislature, and I thank you all for your leadership. I'm hearing such great monumental efforts on the part of all of you to do the right thing for our students and for our staff and for our schools. One thing that's interesting is we keep hearing about the influx of new ESSER funds and how that can help us with a lot of these efforts. One of the core challenges with that is that many of those funds are temporary. And with anything that's temporary, it's people are going to be reluctant to hire permanent staff to fill those roles. You certainly can do some of that in the short term, but to be able to continue, it's hard to hire people on short-term money and then lay them off when that money runs out. And so trying to figure out ways to do this in a responsible way. And I think, and you all, I think, are very well aware of our needs and our interest in trying to secure stable funding that's continuing and ongoing so that we can actually build upon the work that we're doing and try to have it be sustainable. So I guess that's one of the key messages I'll bring forward. We've been on quite a roller coaster ride this past year, but lots of lessons learned, but it's really actually quite fun to look back and see a presentation pre-COVID and remind us of the work that's underway and now is going to be even stronger because we've learned a lot of lessons from our students during this COVID time. So I guess with that, I'll just open it up to questions that you may have for me.
Thank you, Superintendent. Members, questions for Superintendent Osorio on the cost of closing the achievement gap. Representative Pryor.
Right. Thank you, Chair Dabney. So I was there that March 6th, that Friday afternoon. I'm from the very first presentation to the very closing presentation. And it was great to go back to that. And as you stated at the beginning, what we know is I think that was an excellent thing to go back to because all of those issues that we were talking about that day still exist. Mm-hmm. And all of the things that we're working on can still exist. But then we have to layer on top of that what's happened since then in terms of the pandemic and how schools have had to be able to cope with that. And it is just serendipity that you were talking about a Zoom meeting that your students had done. and now you come back on Zoom to talk with us again. So that kind of leads me into, you made a reference to it. You know, so we know, and if everybody that was there that day, and if you didn't have the opportunity, I would recommend the whole day's presentations of understanding the nature of the opportunity gaps and understanding our opportunities for closing it. But can you maybe tell us some things that we know now a year later or more than a year later that's going to help us address the same issue in terms of what we can do for equity in our schools? Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that, Representative Pryor. I will say one thing I have learned that we've been really studying is what are our students and families telling us about their experiences? We know that some of our districts, particularly those like mine, with much higher diversity in them, are seeing, and I know Superintendent Aston Osai in St. Louis Park has talked about this as well, we are seeing higher numbers of students remaining in distance learning while they still have that option to do so. And we're trying to unpack what that's about. So there's all kinds of assumptions that can be made, but we don't want to make assumptions for families. You know, we know that COVID has disproportionately impacted communities of color, but we also know that there could be more to that story. And so at least for us, we're organizing some deep dive focus groups led by members of the community with which students identify with to really unpack some of the reasons, because we know that there might be the COVID concerns, but what are the learning concerns? What are the things that they are finding in distance learning that they weren't having in person? Or what are the threats? Are they facing microaggressions in classrooms that we aren't really aware of, and somehow being in distance learning feels safer? What are some things that, you know, there's going to be a demand for flexibility, innovation, and differentiation that like we've never seen before, because we've been doing more of that now. And I think that, if we really want to get to the core of how to do this really well, we have to start with our own students and their families and what they have to tell us. And that's what we're trying to invest some time in right now and actually do some really deep dive research around, particularly this spring and summer, to really unpack what can we learn about how to make our in-person learning environments stronger. And we've also moved forward with MDE. We've gotten approval to be a permanent online provider, but how do we do that in a rigorous way, in a strong way that also builds community and collaboration? So trying to learn from those experiences that people have had, but also the choices people have made. Why have some students opted to stay in our distance learning? At my high schools, we have over 55% of our students are still in distance learning, even though high schools are fully open. They've opted to stay there, and we want to understand why and what that experience is, what that is doing for them. But we also want to crosswalk that with student outcome data, like course pass rates, attendance, GPA, and also some of the impact that we see on any levels of standardized testing or progress monitoring testing as well. So we're kind of deep in the middle of that work right now as well.
Thank you. And if Mr. Chair, if I can just a follow-up.
Please.
Thank you. And then going back to your presentation from a year ago, which we're still there, and all of that information is still relevant for the question of how we can begin to address equity. You know, one thing that as I think about what I heard before and then was reminded of this year, part of your answer is saying it's like an all of the above. You're mm-hmm. talking about your WIN program and your ROTC and mm-hmm. Social workers in the school and the Sanders Foundation and Saturday classes. So, you know, one thing I'm hearing is that we have to understand that local participation and people doing a variety of things rather than, oh, it's so easy. You know, we can fix it with just this one program if everybody did it or something like that. So if I take that away, am I, you know, somewhat accurate to you know what you were telling us?
Absolutely, Representative Pryor. Thank you, Chair Dabney and Representative Pryor. I would also say a key ingredient is relational. All of these programs we spoke about are very relational based. I think the more we can have students working with adults who understand developmental relationships, also adults who look like them and share certain commonalities with them. Culture, language, race, all those kinds of experiences are critically important. And so the more we can build relational experiences into, you know, programs can't be just stand and deliver content or curriculum. They have to be relational. And that's especially tested us during COVID times and during distance learning and this online environment. And we put a lot of energy into trying to figuring out how do you build relational trust when you're on a screen and what are ways you can do that. And I think that's one of our biggest learnings is to figure out how do we really make sure that's a strong ingredient to any of these programs. And I think it is a menu of options. It's always about including a menu of options.
Representative Pryor? Other members with questions?
I have my hand up.
I'm sorry, I didn't see that, Representative Hassan. Please, thank you for asking.
Thank you, Chair Daphne, and thank you, Superintendent. That was super important conversation. It just like made me realize that was pre-COVID. And we were all back in that room. All of us were all sitting next to each other. No one was worried about catching anything. And I hope we go back to those days because I'm tired of this Zoom life. But I just wanted to highlight that this was before, you know, COVID, and we were talking about the great disparities that were impacting our PIPAC students. And I guess it's safe to say that, you know, COVID has, you know, tremendously added to that inequities, especially for, of course, for PIPAC students, but also for special ed students as well as ELL students. And I heard you talk about some students remaining to still stay in, you know, distance learning, even though schools open. I'm one of those parents like who chose, like my son's school's open, but at first we struggled. The first 6 months of distance learning, we struggled. My son went from A student to C minus, but then we figured it out. And he feels like even though he misses his friend, that this is a better way for him to finish his last year of school. And I hope that, you know, all schools are making space for those parents who, you know, especially for PIPAC parents who, you know, their students, you know, may feel emotionally safe being at home, because we know that, you know, as important as it is to have social connections, you know, microaggressions and racism are, you know, present in this spaces. So if students feel safe, that emotionally safe, that they are at home, that all schools are making that exception for students, even after COVID is done and we're all back to whatever new normal we're going to have. But I just wanted to highlight that, you know, the conversations we had pre-COVID and the conversations we're having post-COVID are still the same conversations, except there's more impact and you know, more inequities today than a year ago. So this just pushes us more forward to fight for equity harder than before. So thank you for this presentation, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. Superintendent Kuchisori, any response?
Thank you, Representative Hassan, and I couldn't agree more. I think that's part of why we have to do a thoughtful job of unpacking their there are a lot of assumptions that can be made about why certain students and families are choosing to stay home. And they are inappropriate to make without hearing from students and families themselves why they are making those choices. Interestingly, our largest demographic right now that's opting to stay home in distance learning are our Asian students by far, which I think is a really interesting piece of data. And I think that there'll be a lot of, I think it's so important that we take time to listen, but that the people who are leading those conversations are not there are people that students know, families feel comfortable talking to, and will be open and honest about how they're feeling and their experiences they're having. So yeah, I think it's critically important.
Thank you, Superintendent. Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Thank you, Superintendent Tushi Osorio. I'm very proud of your leadership in my district, so keep it up. I'll just say one thing, for the Asians, a number of families that I've talked to, they feel the pain of discrimination, getting back to a pandemic blamed on Asians. And so there's a lot to address in going through this, but I know you're on it. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about or get your feedback on early childhood and reading. In your presentation, you mentioned early childhood, and I'm a huge supporter of it as a way to close the opportunity gap. And I'm very convinced with the data from the EPIC study that Ed Minnesota had done, mm-hmm. It closes the gap, but you got to invest. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have any cost figures in your presentation, mm-hmm. but wraparound services in schools. Several schools are doing it. And your thoughts? Yes, it costs an investment, but if it's proven it can close the opportunity gap, why should this not be our vision? And then secondly, just thoughts regarding reading proficiency. We have the benchmark at third grade. We all want this. There's some recommendations in the Senate bill, which we'll get into more. The House will have suggestions. But what are you, as an educator, what are you doing to get 100% as a goal reading proficiency by third grade? So early ed and reading.
Superintendent.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, and thank you, Senator Wieger. I will just say this. I'm so glad you brought that up. And I think at the time of this presentation, I had made the assumption that the House had heard a lot about early childhood, and so I didn't highlight the cost of those programs. But I will say this. Our early childhood program has proven to be critical recently, and I know Senator Wieger knows this because he's not only a member of our district, but he's a former school board member right here in our district as well, and knows very well what happens. But we did a publication for our community a couple years back about the work our kindergarten teachers did with the incoming pre-literacy, early literacy skills that come to the table with our children who have been in early childhood programming. And we have had the benefit of a very large early childhood program through the voluntary pre-K slots and many, we've grabbed every opportunity that has come to us through the legislature. And I will tell you, even this year in COVID times, we use we talk about summative data, which is like the MCA at the end of the year. People say that's your autopsy data. That's what happened after everything was done. But the formative data is that data we talk about every 4 to 6 weeks. How are we measuring success? And we do that with reading and math at elementary levels. And one of the things, we've learned is that our children who've come through our pre-K programs are far, far greater and more advanced than those that haven't. And I don't have that pulled up at the moment, but we actually had a presentation this fall when we did our FastBridge early testing in the fall. We had absolutely, and mine as a district was 67% students of color in it now. In the fall, when we did our FastBridge learning, we had no achievement gap between our white and our black students in kindergarten, even coming off of a spring where we had been in distance learning, because our early, even during distance learning, our early childhood families, a lot of districts, kind of struggled to figure out how do we do distance learning with preschoolers, and our team figured it out and did it, and really rigorously did it, and we were just amazed that it, that we were able to hang on to that. Now we're looking at some end of the year data to see did we hang on to that. But early childhood programming can create all the opportunity. And we have this challenge because our kindergarten staff did this a few years ago. Our first grade staff have this team goal across all 9 schools. Don't let that gap return, because we know what the kindergarten teachers already did with the pre-K teachers with our students and how our students stepped up, and then so it becomes this challenge every year as a cohort moves up. What are you going to do? Are you going to let that gap come back or not? And so it's become this growing challenge. But I think the critically important ingredient is that early childhood learning, the early experience to it's not just letter names and sounds, all of phonemic awareness. How do you hear sounds, rhyming, all those things, phonemic awareness, phonics, but then building into that layers of comprehension and fluency and vocabulary development are critically important.
Senator Wieger?
Thank you. More to come.
Mm-hmm. One question from me, Superintendent. You focused in on the ROTC program, junior ROTC program, as leadership development. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you can just talk about kind of student voices, leadership development. Those were a couple of themes you picked up on, mm-hmm. and how you see those impacting students' education.
Well, I'll give you an example. For us, we really do prioritize student voice and student leadership. We had a situation last week. We had a racial situation, a comment made in a classroom, inappropriately handled, even by a staff member, about the China virus, as you would say. So it was really, really impacted our students, particularly our Asian student community. And so we spent a lot of time connecting with CAL, the Coalition of Asian American Leaders, immediately. Let's talk about how to support, how do we do this work? Obviously, you know, investigations aside, which also has to happen when you're talking about a staff member's involvement, but we also, our team met with a group of student leaders, Asian student leaders, to brainstorm what are some ways that this, to move forward, right? From this harm that's been caused in a classroom environment that was not created in the safest way we would like it to be. And, you know, we would love to say we never have those situations, but you know, unfortunately, you know, when you have 1,700 employees and 11,000 students, something's going to happen sometimes. But what's so important is how you respond. I think the greatest mistakes you see in the media where there are some racial situations that happen in a school is when you see a group of white leaders making a decision about it without gathering and hearing the voice of the community. And when you get to high school, you've got some pretty sophisticated young leaders among you, and they have some really amazing ideas about how to step forward and how do you help process, honor, lift up the voices of students and heal. And I will tell you what has happened in a week's time with a situation that had really bubbled up on social media has been an incredible leadership, completely repair plan and plan created entirely by student leaders, Asian student leaders who wanted to do that response. And that's just an example. I think there's going to be problems. There's going to be crisis. There's going to be situations, but and this is what we would say to our own staff, how you handle it defines who you are. What happens is what happens, but also how you handle it and how you learn and how you grow and how you move forward. And how does it affect and change who you are as a person? And our student leaders, it's just a perfect example of like our high school administrators pulled together and just said, let's have the students help us figure out what's the right way to go forward with this, and families, and of course, community agencies as well. And I think that's an example of not just your day-to-day run-of-the-mill stuff, but when you have a crisis, a problem, and people are hurting, making sure, you know, when we had our student walkout happen, you know, that following the killing of Dwayne Wright, and then prior the day, you know, it was the day prior to, of course, the verdict being read in the Chauvin trial. When our students organized a protest, I called the media and said, please come, you got to see what our students are working on, rather than trying to manage. Of course, as leaders, we're going to always want to make sure there's safety. We're trying to social distance, please sit 3 feet apart, you know. But we called the media and invited our media to come and ask our students about their experience, rather than being afraid of student voices stepping up. But I think when you have good relationships with your students and you know them and your teams, your leaders in your buildings have good relationships, you aren't surprised by things that are underway because they'll talk to you about them and they'll let you know what's going on. And I think, I mean, those are just some examples, but I think it's about making sure that it's not just once in a, it's not the token person on a school board, you know, your student rep on a school board, but it's how do you include and involve student voice in really important decisions about your community and your programming.
Thank you, Superintendent. Thank you for also reminding us that the killings of Dante Wright and George Floyd, of course, have put Minnesota under a national and even international mm-hmm. microscope on, mm-hmm. on how we deal with issues of racism and racial disparities and opportunity gaps. So mm-hmm. seeing no other questions from members, I want to thank you again for both your time last March and the before times and opportunity to go visit those times, as well as your presence here today. Thank you very much, Superintendent.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, and all the rest in attendance. It's a pleasure to join you again. Take care.
Members, to close out the last structural part of the day, we did save the best for last. We often look to center student voices in the deliberation of the House Education Finance Committee, and we reach out particularly to the Minnesota Youth Council for that. As Superintendent Tucci Osorio just said, sophisticated young leaders, and that's who these youth are. So we invited three of those members of the Youth Council to join us today. We're going to start with Salma Abdi, an 11th grader from Century High School in Rochester. Ms. Abdi, please state your name for the record and then provide your testimony. Thank you.
Salma Abdi. Thank you, Chair Dabney and members of the committee. And thank you to everyone who's listening and paying space to hear not just my story and experiences, but those of other students. Again, a little introduction. My name is Salma Abdi, and I'm a junior at Century in Rochester, Minnesota. You know, as a student of color in a predominantly white school, I have had to endure traumatizing experiences in school that have singled me out and made me feel ostracized in class. One of my first experiences was freshman year of high school in my study hall class. You know, before the bell rang, a group of students, including myself and my white peers, were talking to two girls of color. You know, just hanging out, catching up. And when the bell rang, the girls left, we sat down, and in front of the entire class, my teacher came up to me and said, "Are you friends with people like that?" In which I replied, "Yes, because they are my friends. They were my friends." She then went on to tell me how she expected more from me given my grades, and I shouldn't hang out with people like them. Mind you, she did not know any of them. At that point in time, everyone just stared at me, and all I could do was sit there. I was 14, and I had no power. So, and then fast forward 10 minutes later, where I asked if I could go talk to my science teacher, because study hall is about where you can catch up on homework, get the necessary help you need. However, she refused, stating, "If you're friends with people like that, I don't think I can trust you." I was in that class for months by that time, where I was allowed to leave, talk to my teachers, do what I had to do. But she refused, yet still allowed my white peers who were amongst that group to go, clearly singling me out. You know, by the end of the class, I was frustrated. I was angry because why did that happen? Why? And I knew I couldn't idly sit by. I couldn't let that happen because I wouldn't be the first and I wouldn't be the last if I just sat down. So I went to her office and explained why what she did was wrong and was fueled by her biased beliefs. See, now, you know, you might be proud of me. Congrats for advocating. Congrats for standing up for yourself. But that shouldn't have happened. I shouldn't have to advocate for myself. We shouldn't have to advocate for ourselves in a place that is meant to be safe for all students. School is supposed to be a safe environment, yet it fails to do that when it comes to BIPOC students. It fails to allow us to grow and challenge ourselves because we are in a constant state of either having to advocate for ourselves or being silenced. See, one of the few reasons I know that I have luck here compared to some of my peers is because I'm outgoing. I will open my mouth and talk within 5 minutes of meeting you. And people can make up assumptions about me based on what I say, based on my Midwestern accent. For example, I'm one of the few students of color who were born and raised in America that I know of who haven't been in ESL. Most of my friends who have been in it speak English as a first language, yet they ended up in it, thus hindering their ability to achieve greatness. People have to constantly advocate for themselves to be taken seriously. And even as you take more challenging courses, even as a student leader, even as someone people know, I am constantly questioned about my ability to take honor classes, AP classes, PSEO classes. It is immeasurable the amount of times I've been asked. even as an MYC member, an advocate, all of it is taxing. It's taxing to be constantly on high alert because you're the only one in your corner at school. It is tiring to sit in class and have to educate your teachers and peers while simultaneously learning about derivatives. It is tiring to sit in a Socratic seminar, which you like, and have to argue with your peers about why they can't use racial slurs. Existing in class, existing in school is difficult because it is a game of cat and mouse. It is horrendous being the unpaid proxy diversity and equity person, especially when what you say is not taken into account. And you are only in meetings to alleviate white guilt. See, I am always glad to be there. I am glad to advocate. I am glad to make changes, but not at the expense of my mental health, especially when nothing changes. Because if year after year after year, the same issues consistently persist, there's another problem. Being a BIPOC student in Minnesota today is having to compartmentalize because nobody is taking a breath to see how the televised murder of our kin affects us. Our education system doesn't take into consideration the mental health and well-being of BIPOC students. And it is rare for us to view our K-12 experience in a completely positive light. See, the stories I told you today are only a fraction of what I've seen and experienced. And there's only so much I could say right now to capture the emotions that come with rethinking all these issues at 3 a.m, wondering what you could have done differently. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abdi. Next on the list is Sahusra Maletti, a ninth grader at Eastview High School. Ms. Maletti, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Sahusra Maletti. I am a freshman at Eastview High School in Apple Valley, and I am a Congressional District 2 Minnesota Youth Council rep. And this is my first year on the council, and I'm a 14-year-old Indian student. I am here today to speak up about the lack of opportunities and experiences students of color face. As a kid, I always looked forward to school because it felt like a space where I could truly be myself. I was always very involved, but I still worked hard on my studies. Overall, I would say I was a pretty good student. My favorite part of school, however, was making friends with as many people as I could, because I really enjoyed socializing and spending time with other people. However, around the start of middle school, I started experiencing microaggressions and being ostracized for reasons I could not understand at the time. I remember one moment specifically when our class was talking about who we wanted to be when we grow up. Since I've always been interested in politics, I named that I dreamed of being the President of the United States. However, instead of my classmates saying, "I'll vote for you," or being really supportive, many of them responded that if you're Indian, you won't be president, and you have to be born in the U.S. to have a chance. It really affected my confidence and my interest in politics and government at the time. But it wasn't until middle school and these past few months in high school that I felt as though I had to be aware of my race at every moment. Since I'm taking a couple of advanced honors classes this year, I guess many people would say I have a reputation for being a smarter kid. However, I am tired of being stereotyped as an Indian kid that only studies and cares about grades. Many people who I used to consider to be my friends made jokes about me, saying that I go home and write 5-page essays for fun and that I can't hang out with anyone because I'm too busy studying. At the time, I let them continue with their hurtful words, but it slowly affected me and me feeling comfortable in school. However, this past year in ninth grade, every small rude remark people have said has slowly piled up for me. Positive stereotypes hurt just as much as negative ones because people assume who you are and assume that they know exactly everything about your life without even getting to know you. From kids around me making fun of me for taking advanced classes or saying that I must be bad at sports for being Indian, I've become tired and hurt from all the hate I experience in school and my extracurricular activities each day. In fact, just today at my school, some girls made fun of what I was wearing, saying they expected me to wear something more proper or demure because of my race. I'm tired of seeing students of color feel ostracized or that they don't fit in because of what everyone says around them. I'm disappointed that one of my own Indian friends started taking on-level classes to not fit into the stereotype after she was bullied all throughout middle school. And I am tired of students of color in my school and all over Minnesota feeling like they have no friends and that they're not enough. I believe students of color struggle so much and deserve to have more opportunities. Many of us work very hard but are overlooked due to the color of our skin. I want adults to fight for the rights of students of color and to try their hardest to help us feel accepted. Because I know that I and many of my peers that are students of color just want to fit in. Thank you. I yield my time to the chair.
Thank you very, very much, Ms. Moletti. And last of these sophisticated young leaders, as Superintendent Osorio referenced them, is Isabel Wong from Apple Valley High School. Ms. Wong, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Isabel Wong, and I'm a senior at Apple Valley High School. Where to start? So I have gone to predominantly white schools my whole entire life. And one thing that I can say is that no matter what school that I've gone to, because I've gone to a lot, no matter what space that I'm in, it always ends up being the same. It always ends up to where these students of color are ostracized and forced to take accountability for actions that aren't theirs, especially in things like social studies classes. One of the hardest things about going to school, especially these days, especially when you're going and learning about current events, when you're learning about global things happening around the world and even throughout history, it's about the teachers that have such a one-sided view, especially because they are in a place of privilege, because most of the time, especially in predominantly white schools, you have teachers that are white. In my whole entire school career, I have only ever had one person of color as a teacher. And mind you, I'm a senior. So that's a long time without ever seeing someone that has shared an experience of marginalization with me. And understanding that these points of views, especially when you're looking at them through social studies, it can come to the point where you begin to hate your race and you begin to hate the history that comes along and the heritage. It's AAPI month right now, but we never learn about things that matter and things that have happened to the Asian community. And all the hate crimes that are happening now have forced people to look at things in a different way, forced people to see how Asian Americans are a marginalized community. And it has led to a lot of confusion, especially for a lot of my white peers, because they think, oh, Asian Americans, they believe in the model minority myth. And they further see this so-called proximity to whiteness that Asian Americans don't have. There's this really interesting concept that I learned at a U of M class called racial triangulation. It's a really interesting topic. Everyone should go learn about it, but it's just like, there are things that we aren't taught and we are forced to hate so much. Like when we look at Vietnam War, we see that America wasn't in the wrong. Instead, we heroify these actions of America and we are centralized on America's actions, even though they harm the people elsewhere. It's things like curriculum that can start very small, even with your teacher saying words wrong. And it leads to students realizing, oh, if that teacher can say that word wrong, and it can sound like a derogatory word, then I can say it too. And it gets to the point where students are going up to you and calling you Ling Ling or saying Ching Chong. It's the little things like that from class, starting in class, that can expand and greatly determine the outcome of a student's mental health. So I just think that with looking at curriculum and starting with that plan and having students understand each perspective, especially those that come from foreign entities, those perspectives is incredibly important. I yield my time to the chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wong. Members, any questions for our youth testifiers today?
Chair Dabney.
Oh, Chair Moran.
I just want to say to our students first, thank you. Thank you for bringing your voices into this conference committee as we are making decisions about how we can value and support and invest in every student. But also just raising a real insight for us to know that inequities, racism, and all that is real, right? And it impacts you mentally. And what impacts you mentally can also have a great impact on your learning and your growth and your development. But I just want to say just thank you for being so brave and taking this time to come and just share with us. I hear you, I see you, and I do better understand how important it is for us to move forward to create an educational system that's going to support all our students, especially our students of color, and that diversity, it matters. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Moran. Any other comments or questions from members for our youth testifiers? Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to reiterate what Representative Moran said. That was so powerful, what the students said. And yeah, I wish we could yield a couple of hours the way they yielded back to you so respectfully. I was wondering if each of them, if they wanted to respectfully yield to comment on what the lack of consequences, in their buildings regarding the issues. Are there student organizations able to have a voice at the table? Are they able to express something, whether it's through the student rep on the school board, or there must be some current ways of addressing this as well. We need to do more, obviously. So just in terms of when you're knocking on the door for change within your own building, comment more about, any ray of hope there. And then secondly, I'm just real interested in what you might be thinking of each of you for your career, because each of you are going to be so impactful.
So because Senator Wieger asked each of you, I'll just go through you in the same order that you testified, if you wish. So Ms. Abdi.
Thank you, Chair Dabney and Senator Wieger. So one of the things you can really do is I'm the type of person, if there's no chair for me at the table, I'll bring one, always advocating for yourself. There's no specific student rep on our school board, but there are quite a lot of youth organizations that work to change things in our school district. One big one is Rochester Community Initiative down here in Rochester. One of the big things a lot of students within it organized is our school district had this thing where there was a lot of rumors about teachers being told by an administration that they couldn't talk about the Black Lives Matter movement or anything political. And a lot of students organized to, I would call it, change that. So our school board adopted a few phrases that they encourage, including Black Lives Matter. I think that's one big thing that's happened. And, but, you know, like, there's no specific person to go to really address your concerns. It's more of what can you do yourself? And even then, sometimes it's very difficult to get your voice heard or to see actual consequences. And then your second question, what I'm thinking of going into, I want to major in economics and hopefully work in public policy.
Thank you, Ms. Abdi. Ms. Mulledy.
Hello, thank you, Chair Daphne and Senator Rieger. As far as consequences in our school, for the microaggressions that I've experienced or the racist things that kids have said to me, I have not seen any consequences from those. I've never reported them to teachers, but I'm working on that because something that I actually struggled with in middle school and over this past year of my first year of high school is being confident enough to share your experiences. And I know a lot of my friends struggle from this as well, because a lot of times you're not sure if you're reading into it too much or if you're over-exaggerating something. And it's really hard to know, like, am I actually being hurt? Are people actually saying racist things to me? Or am I just looking into it and overreacting, which is something really difficult for me, but I've definitely been working on that. But actually our school, I think it was last week, we had a Black Lives Matter walkout, and there was like one teacher there. And I remember a student was speaking, and he was talking about how it's really difficult for him when he has to go outside and people treat him like he's a threat to society. And he asked everyone, am I a threat to society? And everyone said no, except for one kid that yelled yes. And it was supposed to be a safe space for everyone, and the administration didn't do anything, which was really frustrating. And then on top of that, that same day, someone hacked into our school's media account, and they posted something really racist, and they're still trying to figure out who did it. But it's just really frustrating when you finally get the confidence to share about your experiences and share about what you've struggled with, and then people still hate on you. And even when they're called out for it, they continue to do some wrong things. But as far as what I'm interested in, even though some people did make comments about it in my school, I still want to go into politics and somewhere in the government.
Very good. And Ms. Wong, you are the 12th grader. And so the second question of Senator Uyghur's tends to carry a little more weight and perhaps a little bit more stress for you and what next year might be than the other students. But please go ahead, responding to both of Senator Uyghur's questions.
Thank you, Chair Daphne. Thank you, Senator Uyghur. So as far as the microaggressions, it's similar to what Sahasrara said. There have not been any consequences for the people that have said harmful things or done racist things. It's a lot about holding people accountable, and it's really tiring as a person of color and as a student for you to have to do that. It gets to like little things, to where I'm correcting teachers' pronunciation, to how to say a name, like Mao Zedong, instead of like Mao Zedong, which is like something people should know, but obviously that's a little rocky, I guess. But I remember I had talked to one of my teachers about a racist name that I hadn't called, and instead of talking to that person one-on-one, they made excuses for that person and said, well, they don't know. You should have talked to them and you should have the ability to call them in. But like when someone is attacking you, I guess is a good word, for your race, then it's like hard to call that person in when you don't know if they're going to do it again, right? So that's just like small things of not really knowing and not being able to hold other people accountable because you're supposed to be holding them accountable when they're not doing it and you have no one behind you to support you. I do have a position on my school district's legislative advisory council. And that's been a place that I've definitely been advocating for teachers of color, for the Teachers of Color Act to get more funding and to pass. I think it passed in 2018, if I'm not correct. It might've been just last year too. And District 196 is also does have a racial equity council as well. So I know that that's another platform that they're trying to level the playing field for everyone. And as for what I plan to do, well, like Chair Daphne said, it's a little more stressful, but next year I am actually going to be spending a year abroad in Taiwan. And that's with the National Security Language Initiative for Youth. It's a program from the government that's just like to allow for connections to happen. And then after that, I'm hoping to attend Reed College in Portland, Oregon. And there I will major in sociology and hopefully find a place where I can use that degree.
All right, fantastic. An adventurous year ahead for you then. Congratulations on that. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to echo the gratitude for the students coming forward and speaking with us and speaking so, sharing their stories, which it's actually difficult to listen to. And then you imagine how difficult it would be to also have to live those experiences. And what I heard each one of you say is that you're feeling these microaggressions, these basically attacks because of the way you look, just part of your school day, you know, and we're responsible for education there. So this is our responsibility, what's happened to you. So not only are you experiencing these negative interactions with other students and with teachers as part of our system, but then also you're the one that's supposed to lead us forward and bring attention to them and advocate for yourself and solve the problem. So, you know, obviously we've let you down in many ways, and that's why we're very serious about what can we do to make the change. And I have to say, you know, going back to our first speaker about if you're inside a restaurant getting fed and the people outside see a closed sign and you only see the open sign inside. And I remember where I was on the outside and had that closed sign, which was a similar experience with Ms. Maletti. When I was in the sixth grade, I had a very vigorous debate with the boys in my class about the possibility of a woman ever being president. And they were 100% positive that the day will never come and that it was foolish for any woman to even think that you might be president someday. And that was, that was a long time ago for me, that story that it happened. And so far they've been right. So there's that. But I did make it this far as a state representative here as a woman. And I think the boys were telling me I couldn't even get this far. So I've seen the closed sign and I know that it's still there. So thanks all, all of our representatives here for speaking. What your experience has been and inspiring us to do better in the future.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Seeing no other hands raised from members, again, thank you to the three youth testifiers for sharing your experiences, sharing your time, and sharing your perspective with us today. Senator Chamberlain, that's the House presentation for today. Again, we wanted you to understand the kind of the two primary I might say, drivers for us this year in our deliberations, that of more equitable educational experiences and outcomes for all Minnesota students, because we believe all Minnesota students deserve a world-class education. And then also centering those youth voices. I learned a lot from these testifiers today. We've been lucky enough to partner with Minnesota Youth Council in the past and have other youth testifiers, as well as Ms. Abdi has testified before the committee in the past as well. But any preview of coming attractions for tomorrow, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Thank you, testifiers. Thanks for sharing thoughts and ideas today. For tomorrow, we will begin the walkthrough on the side-by-side. So not an exciting day, but nonetheless, the first step in moving forward. So coffee and all those things, or whatever you need to do to make yourself comfortable, get through that. But we have a great staff, blessed to have them, and they'll get it done for us. So thanks again to all of you, Mr. Chair, and all the testifiers, and the insight and the information you shared. That's all I have.
Thank you, Chair Chamberlain. I know when I chaired the property tax division in the House, I would occasionally tell constituents that I do the boring stuff so they don't have to, because that can get a little dry. Hopefully, education not so much, but we'll see. Look forward to your having the gavel tomorrow. Members, staff, testifiers, thank you all for your efforts today, your presence, and your attention. Look forward to seeing you all back again tomorrow. Thank you. We are adjourned.